because of the poetic evening prayer City had made me write, I was convinced that they do believe in God. But what kind of a God? A personal God? An impersonal God? Or perhaps, as I began to suspect, God nature, with nature being God itself? The symbol of Linilan, was it really the symbol of this God? What I was offered finally is a new and original pattern of their way of believing in God. I consider the original form of their cosmophilosophic pattern. From the 23rd to the 26th of February, I filled the last part of my notebook with interesting notes all about the religious belief of my friends, their ceremonies, habits and even sacred holidays. The amazing fact was that during our discussions, I was informed that there are civilizations in the cosmos having formed some kind of an intercosmic ring. All these civilizations live on planets with much the same life-spending conditions as our planet Earth. Naturally, because of this, I immediately asked City if there was a possibility that these people, like science fiction pretends, could invade our world and destroy every human being on Earth. Perhaps, I said to City, they would want to do so because of our cruelty. But, smiling mildly, she said, your cruelty is part of your general development pattern. In other words, our friends believe that the higher we step up the ladder of evolution, the less cruel and selfish humanity should be. On the 25th of February, I find a note in my diary, humanity and cosmos could not exist. If they lived selfishly and cruelly, they could not exist, if they would not love God nature. Since the days I noted Xity's words, I have come to believe that true religion on Earth has not even been born, that it is not necessary to start new religious beliefs or even reform those available to our souls. But this I do know, with the help of cosmophilosophy we shall find the way to true religion. Perhaps doing so we shall take another look at our present misinformed views and return to the simplicity of our original leaders, Buddha, Moses, Jesus, Muhammad and many more. Perhaps through cosmophilosophy we shall come to understand that all of us live on one and the same motherland, that this motherland, this beautiful planet of ours is part of a greater intercosmic development pattern with many civilizations belonging to the same great human family. But most of all, because of cosmophilosophy, humanity shall find out very soon that this mother planet of ours is big and powerful enough to make a decent living possible to all our suffering brothers and sisters. It is all up to us, to every one of us. And when shall we find this out? I had asked. As soon as you stop hating and killing each other, was Xity's logical answer. Footnote, Talayan, the greatest of all Itibiran reformers, altered the concept of a superstitious belief in personal gods into the now universally accepted belief in God nature. After the retirement of Talayan, as Itibiran president and religious leader, the word God was never again used, instead it became God nature. Map on about distances on this excursion to the Barranquilla area, a journey that Google Maps estimates to take 4.5 hours by plane and certainly a fraction of this with their flying saucers. Chapter 15. The Cancer Planet. On February the 26th, 1967, shortly before I wanted to retire, it must have been between 10 and 11 p.m. I was told by Xity that Mr. Satura wanted to see me in his communications center, located in the middle lower section of the spacecraft. I had never been there. It was Xity herself who took me. Satura was not alone. Most of the scientists were with him, seated comfortably. What I noticed was their very solemn expressions. During an interview of about only 2 minutes, I was informed that the Itibirans had received a command to evacuate the plantations and return to their mother planet. It was Xity again who showed me the way out, but before I left, Satura offered me his sincere thanks for my assistance to his sister in Lima. Then Mr. Hua, in the name of all the scientists who did not talk to me, as they did not carry language computers, said thank you for my help in finding the wonderful Nuba plant. All this happened very fast. I did not know what to think. At about 12:30 when I still could not find sleep, I got up. With great difficulty I found my way down to the centrally located communication center. Perhaps Satura, now all by himself, had felt my approach and invited me to come inside this his most private quarters. Here, sipping the exotic fine flavors of his favorite juices, we stayed together until dawn, talking and discussing many unforgettable subjects. During these last 5 hours, I found out many things about my friends. Because of the very informal atmosphere, I did not mind asking Satara questions of such a personal nature as to his age. I asked him about the future of humanity, about myself, about Xity, his parents and his work. Satara, the most intelligent human being I ever met, took all his time during our last conversation to give me sincere and friendly answers. What he mentioned about the 5 billion people of another planet far from their own, I believe to be of interest. It should be taken seriously and as a warning. In 11,000 years, since the last of the Atlantic islands submerged forever, only 22 to 25 generations of Itiberans have lived within the same time. It becomes obvious that with the tremendous power of their eye generators and intercosmic memory computers, the words of our friends should be taken seriously. To me, his religious wisdom has become a guiding light for my entire life. It is the reason why I began to write this book as soon as I returned to Lima. Cancer planets were mentioned during our conversation and I asked many questions. A cancer planet, I was informed, is a universe of its own. A universe, because people on such a planet sincerely believe they do not need God. They have advanced technically in such a way that they have created an entirely artificial pattern of life. They have invented the most sensational machines, gadgets, power equipment, artificial food, color, air, even artificial war machines and chemical weapons, able to destroy their neighbors. Their artificial way of life has made them believe that they are superior to any other civilization in cosmos. But God, Mr. Satara said sadly, has given them cancer. Their inventions and creations, my friend said, are not like the Itiberan creations. They are not working in harmony with God nature, nor does God nature work in harmony with them. More than 70% of 5 billion people die of cancer. Still, they refuse to believe that cancer is no ordinary sickness. For many years they hope for a cure, a self-made cure against nature. They refuse to believe that God is nature and nature is God. They want to feel superior to cosmophilosophic law, which says, disregarding the laws of nature is disregarding the laws of God, because God is nature and nature is God. I was able to understand that the Itiberans do have special religious laws against all excesses, including the use of artificial cancer-producing agents. I asked my friend to let me know these religious laws and Satara dictated them to me. I call them the 7 cosmophilosophic commandments. The Itiberans, he explained, are very much concerned with this cancer planet and he called this planet a total cosmic dropout. Satara described the contempt and superior price of the cancer planet's people as a direct threat to other human beings in cosmos. He called it an obligation to correct this offense against nature and God. Not a political move, but a religious call for combined action. Not to kill or destroy, but to force the leaders of this cancer planet to return to the true wisdom of their ancestors' cosmophilosophy. How, I wanted to know, would they force them to do this? Mr. Satara explained that the combined plan was to interfere with the cancer planet's established cosmic routing and, in particular, its distance from its own sun. By doing so, they hoped to freeze the planet into several progressive ice age periods. Listening to this, I couldn't help wondering if all this was serious, but Satara definitely insisted that their return to Tibira was due to this plan. Also, my friend believes that such a natural catastrophe would force the people on that planet to unite in self-defense against God nature and stop using the many self-produced artificial cancer agents. God nature shall force them to return to their former health. As final advice to all our brothers and sisters on this our beloved planet Earth, my friend begs us to obey and study nature as a part of God. He said, the forces of God are the forces of nature and the forces of nature are the forces of God. The last remaining hour, before the Itiberans took me to the Peruvian Highland Lake, the same location of our takeoff on 7th of February, 1967, I spent with Xity, who surprised me with an amazing present, a goodbye present and a present for my entire life, a present none of my readers would think possible or have the imagination to guess. Chapter 16. The Orphan Girl. During the entire time I had been with my friends at the Merrim River, I was never aware of little Dolores, and I suppose that if their departure had not been of such an extreme urgency I probably would have never seen or heard of the little girl. Why they kept her out of my sight I shall never know, but in the early hours of the morning of the 27th of February, 1967, it was Xity herself who introduced me to Dolores. This is the story of Dolores, the Itabirans called Lola because little Dolores herself wanted to be called by the shorter abbreviation, Lola. To find some clues to the mysterious appearance of the six-year-old Indian girl I simply did not have the time. What I was told was this: Xity had taken the little girl from Satara some time ago and had wanted to return with her to Itabiratu, hoping that the six-year-old girl would be able to adjust herself and not die, like the mother of Sister Marie in Avidad. Why, at the last moment, Xity decided to let me take the girl back to the Peruvian capital, was, she explained, because of a direct order from their home planet. For many thousands of years, spacecraft of theirs, and others, have had trouble with some magnetic forces of a very small but extremely dangerous planet called Tabra or Tagra. This Tagra, as I prefer to call it, seems to be disturbing their plans as far as the Cancer planet is concerned. As no human beings live on Tagra, Mr. Hua, the second in command, together with seven cosmonauts and several women scientists, including Xity, received the order to investigate and possibly destroy this planet. As Lola, the little girl had taken a fancy to Xity, but as Xity felt it too dangerous to take her along, I was asked to become a father. Just like that, a father for an orphan girl. When I first saw the child I fell in love with her immediately. Not at all shy, she seemed to be at home in a part of the spacecraft, a separate section I had never known. The little girl had taken a real liking, not only to Xity, like as to a mother, but also to Satara. He had found her about 6 months before near the road from Urcos to Cuzco while investigating the religious symbols of some pre-Inc ruins. Very close to the desolate ruins a small path ran down from the hills and Satara had seen the child running towards him calling for help. The little girl, with bleeding feet, was begging him to follow her to see her mother. As Xity told me, the child had spoken in Spanish, Sir Sita, Mama to say Muir. Very close, Mummy is dying. But Sir Sita in the Peruvian highlands means 2 hours' walk and when Satara finally came to the miserable hut the mother of the girl was dead. As a biologist, Satara could see that Lolo's mother had died of undernourishment, of hunger, and that the whimpering little girl was at the verge of death herself. Besides a few olotes, the half-empty stems of corn cups, there was absolutely nothing to eat and Satara immediately gave the little girl 1/3 of a life-saving tablet. He let her sip from his own juice container until the control craft was able to arrive at a clearing nearby. Within 2 days, Xity said, the girl had taken a liking to the Itabirans. To my friends, from a more refined and civilized world, the task of taking care of a minor must have meant no problem, particularly because of the fantastic health centers. But to find myself one very early morning near the Peruvian town of La Union with Dolores in my arms, shivering in the cold until some kind truck driver took us towards the town of Ayo, that is quite a different story. Not that I minded taking care of the little girl, but the suddenness of the whole thing, the tears in Xity's eyes and her last sweet words, the strange breathing of hers while saying goodbye and her sudden decision to return the ring she had taken from me at the Lima hospital, all this made me wonder, what next? Also, as I had spent most of my Peruvian money in Colombia, buying the useless camera Satara had given back to me, I had only enough money to buy a Colectivo fare to Lima, besides a few overripe bananas. During the bumping ride down the mountain road towards Machucana, and the great Peruvian capital, we ate our bananas and listened to the car radio. There were five more passengers in the car and Lola had to sit on my knees. To become a father, I thought, is very easy, but to be a father and especially a father to a six-year-old little girl without papers or relatives, that, I thought, is going to be a problem. It takes about 4 hours from Oyo to Machucana, and during the entire time I was thinking about what I should do with little Lola. Finally I found the right solution. In Lima I had known a wonderful French lady. Having been married to a Peruvian officer, she was now a widow, living in a beautiful house in the capital S Garden district of Miraflores. When we reached Lima at about 4 p.m, I went immediately to change and get some money, then off to a modern department store. I bought some clothes for Lola, had an early supper, and at 7 p.m. I was ringing the bell at the garden entrance of my old friend. Little Dolores, in spite of having lived in a spacecraft, must never have seen such splendor as this magnificent house, near the blue Pacific. She was frightened, but before nightfall, at 8 p.m, little Lola had made friends, not only with the little old lady, but with her two little dogs, Pommy and Bella. As I felt much too tired to explain things to our hostess besides what could I possibly have told her, I just asked her to do me the great favor and watch the little girl for a couple of days, as her parents had to do some work for me out of town. Thanks to the general laissez vivre which prevails over all South America, she did not ask questions. Also, I had offered to pay for little Lola's keep. When I finally wanted to leave, I found that Lola did not want me to go. She started crying and I stayed with her, looking at the television until she got sleepy and we took her to bed. A couple of days later, after I had finished the installation of a grinding plant in Callao, the port of Lima, I was told by the old lady that under no circumstances would she want me to take the girl from her, nor did she want any money from me for Dolores. There is an amusing sequel to this story. When I returned from Europe the following year, one looked up my good friend. I hardly recognized the elegant seven-year-old young lady who came into the drawing room, particularly as she rattled off a greeting in perfect French. But it was my little Lola right enough. She called my friend Mama Française. The bond between the lonely woman and the young girl, the two white dogs included, was deep and affectionate. But in a way I was disappointed. The beautiful little Indian girl, having been legally adopted, now looked and talked as if she had come from Paris. I still wonder what the Itibirans would think of that. Footnote: I have often thought that it could have been because of scientific and anthropological interests that the Ibirans had the little girl on board. But, I must confess, that after thinking it out I came to the conclusion that these people are unable to act with deliberate intention. I believe they wouldn't even have the cruelty to put a monkey into a rocket and blow it up to the moon, and see what happens to the poor creature. Much less would they want to make experiments with a little girl. The girl was on that spacecraft, simply because she was found without parents, crying, undernourished and starving with hunger. Chapter 17. The oldest religion on Earth. During the years 1967 and 1968 I wound up my affairs in Lima. There were two other installations to be finished, and then I was free to return to the USA and Europe. One of the interesting things I discovered when having a farewell drink with my friends from the university was that they knew of a certain guerrilla activity in the area where I had thought the Miriam River Flavor Plantation to be located. Checking the best maps of the Amazon, I came to the conclusion that my first idea of the Itibiran settlement was absolutely inconceivable with the correct topography of this part of South America. Some of my friends, who did believe my story, suggested that the Miriam River camp must have been much further south, perhaps towards the River Porcatumbo. I told them that the Indian criminal who had ventured into the plantation headquarters definitely had talked about the Miriam and Letitia section. Also, Teru had mentioned Iquitos. On the other hand, my friends pointed out that some years ago many strange new plants had been discovered by a French explorer near the town of Pucallpa. One of these they called a special flavor pollen-producing flower, about the thickness of a double-size asparagus, while, thickened with the most delicious perfume. A color photo of this discovery was printed in one of the leading South American magazines. I am convinced that it is one of the pollen-producing plants from Itabirat who my friends must have left behind after they abandoned their first plantation. The red mark where his friend thought the plantation was, and Lima is farly down to the left of the map, and the inland sea, Lake Junin, where they were first picked up by the vessel that brought them to the plantation, February 17, 1967. When I left the Peruvian capital, my friends from the university voluntarily issued a very nice reference in regard to the research work and the technical installation I had done for them in the year 1966 and rechecked during my stay in Lima in 1967. I had taken a personal interest in the Peruvian food problem. The ring, which Xiti had returned to me before leaving, I had already shown to several experts living in Holland. In order to get a better vision of the engraved symbol, I had the ring's photo enlarged. From the illustration you may see yourself that the metal insert, the heart of an ancient god some of my friends believe to be the image of the first human god ever pictured, and which I came to accept as the oldest religious symbol in the entire universe, used by the Itabirat scientists as a magnetic sender and receiver in connection with their highly developed control centers, or perhaps their eye generator and brain computers, must have had a religious significance already thousands, perhaps millions of years ago. The pre-Inca, pre-Aztec and pre-Mayan civilizations all show a similar symbol. But also the earliest Egyptian pharaohs had similar symbols engraved on their tombs. Many of the same symbols have been found in the temples of India. All this is proof that the first and most ancient religion of mankind must have been close to one and the same belief in God nature. The very same belief that Mr. Satura had mentioned during our last discussion on board the spacecraft during the night of February 26. Later, of course, the Mayas, and especially the Aztecs and Incas must have changed this belief into a multi-god belief, the god of sun, the god of rain, a god of the wind, etc., etc. Today, if we study the Mexican and Peruvian temples we find many similar symbols and it becomes obvious that at one time the North American and South American continent must have been the seat of human civilization. Between this former world and its ancient secrets, a veil of many thousands of years has descended and the chances are that we shall never get through to the many mysteries behind this veil. Aided by the disappearance of the Atlantic continent, which was the link between Africa and Europe, aided by our own superstitious beliefs and dogmatic form of thinking, the truth about this, our very first religion, about people who knew about an intercosmic society with similar religious symbols, may never come to light. Even today, these symbols, secretly, form part of the South American Indian's religious feeling. Without knowing it, and deep in their hearts, all over Mexico, Central and South America, many Indians cherish the belief that one day the Inca and pre-Inca, pre-Mayan and pre-Aztec god shall claim his former rights and rule the American continent. In the power of their gold and silver thirsty conquerors, the lot of the Indians fell from bad to worse. Perhaps secretly they still long for these their former gods to come to life again. Even under the rags of contempt and humility the former pride in one and the same god, the god of nature, has been kept alive. It is significant that our friends of out of space, who regard all people, regardless of color and creed, as part of one and the same intercosmic human family, should know the same symbol of God nature. Isn't it amazing that the most primitive men on our planet should have known the same religious symbol of God as the most advanced civilization of another world? Isn't it proof that God is the same to all mankind in the universe? Isn't it proof that cosmophilosophy is part of all mankind in cosmos? The incredible fact that many times we have been visited by out-of-space people, is also shown on many South Indian religious paintings. I have taken a photograph of such a painting. It shows the covered face of God nature with two spacecrafts pictured on the goddess sacred cloth. At a closer look, we are able to see the negative and positive upper and lower sections of the flying craft, the intercosmic cellular receivers and senders, the reactionary central generator and command units within the reactionary central generator. This primitive design of a flying saucer corresponds almost with my own observation, with the exception that the center units were not square, as shown on the religious painting. I have shown this painting to an Indian professor on a visit to London. This man had been to Tibet in the years 1947 and 1948. He told me that even in Lhasa, on the roof of the world, he had observed religious symbols with flying machines pictured. Chapter 18. Paradise. More than 2 years have passed. Since then I have moved to Central America in order to be near on my business in that part of the world. I had first stayed at hotels and an extremely good pension, but soon I was looking for privacy. I wanted to write this book in a place of perfect isolation. Looking for a small property near the tropical lakes of Central America, I had contacted a real estate agent. I told the man that I had heard a great deal about their local beauty spot and that if he had any properties on his books on the lake area, then I would be pleased to consider them. He could not have been more helpful. Indeed, he had several properties on the northern shore's a delectable location and he was sure that I would find one to suit my purpose. With that, he invited me to step into his car and he drove me out to the properties. I've traveled a good part of this world. I suppose I've seen many beauty spots, but to be absolutely honest, there's not one that could match this Central American lake. Its tropical water is a deep yet shimmering blue. Islands are dotted here and there. The ground rises in terraces round the huge lake. Beyond are vast mountains. It is a picture postcard paradise. The estate agent saw my look of appreciation and must have thought about raising his commission. "You like it?" he inquired. It was not so much a question as a statement of fact. It is superb. There is no other word. I could spend the rest of my days here. I took the first property I had seen. It was a fishing and hunting lodge, with a series of terraces, its own water system from a motor pump installed inside a deep well. Well-constructed stairways led down the series of terraces. The whole place was like an eagle's nest, perched high above the tropical waters. The house itself was on the central terrace. The garage was on the top terrace. Wherever you look, you are met with such breathtaking views so that the eye is almost surfeited with natural beauty. The formalities were hurried through. Within 48 hours I had the key of the property, and had installed myself, my luggage and a housekeeper. I spent the whole of the first day of my tenancy wandering round the house and grounds, climbing the various terraces, feasting my eyes on the stupendous scenes and taking a swim from the little private beach. It was a perfect day, a gem of a day even for Central America, which has one of the most amenable of tropical climates. Again and again I had to admire the magnificent Maquiliscuas trees growing all the way up to the huge and somber San Vicente volcano, lording over the entire landscape. Fortunately, I thought, San Vicente has been described as a good-natured and well-tempered volcano. But who can really trust a real estate agent in a hurry to make a sale? One cough from San Vicente and this paradise and the property could be devastated. On the second day after I had entered into my private paradise, I got out my typewriter and began to write the story of my adventures with the Itibarans. From the day that I first met Satura on the Madras Night Express, I had lost some of my diaries and it wasn't an easy job to find dates and names. Certain places and words I had synchronized by sound I could not write down in human language at all. I simply had to use similar words and sentences so far as the dialogue with these people is concerned. However, the story was still so vivid in my mind that I practically had a total recollection of the most important events. I forgot all about the real reason for my coming to Central America as I pounded, rather inexpertly, the keys of the typewriter. My housekeeper fed me at regular intervals. Other than that, I was not disturbed. Although I am not a skilled writer, yet the words flowed. Each night the pile of manuscript grew. Yet, as I read what I had written I came to the conclusion that all this would be in vain, because who would want to believe such a story? It is a concatenation of unlikely circumstances for which I can offer very little explanation.